Welcome to the Permatemp Corporation. A presentation of the audio podcast, This Is Actually Happening. Episode 27. What if you survived a deadly plague?
I think I was always out. I knew at a very early age. I knew it, I would say around 4 or 5, that I was different. When I was like 8, I remember being in the library and looking at what the definition of homosexuality was and seeing that it was listed as a mental disorder and that it was a sickness. And I remember thinking, well, I'm not sick. I don't consider myself sick. I'm a good student and I'm responsible. So I never bought into that at all. But I knew I was going to have to lead a double life very early on because my mother was very mindful of what other people thought and very concerned that she present the right 50s profile to the world and her family in terms of everybody being happy and peppy and you know, not necessarily church going, but just that everybody fit the social norm. I officially came out when I was on a trip to Cape Cod with my family, and we were in Provincetown, and I'd read that Provincetown was, you know, very, very gay. And I would say I was probably about 14 at this time, 15 or whatever. And as we were walking through Provincetown with my mother and my father and my 3 sisters, I noticed this guy on the other side of the street checking me out. And I was, even at the time, I thought, okay, well, let's see, it's 5:30, and I know that this is what's called a cruise. And I know I'm being cruised, and I'm with my parents, and I don't think it's going to be that great that they know. So I said to my parents, well, I'll just meet you later. I'll meet you down the block. And they said, okay, and they drifted away, and I marched right up to the guy across the street. I mean, here I was like 14 or so, and I said, okay, so where do we go? And the guy was a little taken aback, but he initiated me in a rather brief, clumsy fashion, and I was off and rolling. He was maybe around mid-20s, so you couldn't get much more chicken than a 14-year-old, you know? 14, when I think of it. What the hell was I doing? I could have been cut up all kinds of different ways. Oh, man. But I did it. And then I thought, yep, that works. And I came back to where we were living. And I said, well, I'm going to get more of that because, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I set up this meticulously planned plot of double life where I was a straight-A student. Nobody ever had to worry about me, never caused anybody any trouble. And I would say to my mom, I'm going to take the car down. I need to borrow your car on Saturday to go downtown to work on a paper at the library. There was a bookstore downtown that had a very small section of gay-themed books and magazines. And the only magazine was out was this thing called Demigod that had a bunch of men with greasy hair in posing straps. And I would just march in, my little 16-year-old, and just plant myself right next to that little stand and wait, open for business. And I would just wait. What the hell was I doing? And I never for 1 minute felt any kind of fear whatsoever. And that's what it was all about. It was leading an incredibly closeted life. But I was not ashamed in any way, shape, or form of who I was. And I was just going to go ahead and lead this life, and that's all there was to it. Very careful not to reveal anything to any parent or anybody at school. But when I think of the risks I was running, you know, there was never one moment of an hour of a day that I wasn't 100% gay. There was never a moment where I thought to myself, well, I could perform here, but this would be my preference. No, it was always the fact that I was just 100% gay. I wasn't going to deny it to myself. I would hide it from other people, but I wasn't going to hide it from myself. The late 60s came around and I decided to go to college. And I knew exactly what college I wanted to go to. I wanted to go to a liberal arts college in New England that was co-ed and you know, where languages were strong, and that was Middlebury. But the assumption was, of course, I just would not be able to be who I was, so I made the deal with myself that I would go to Middlebury, and during the school year, I would just be a student and a friend and not do anything on campus, but then on vacations, I would just give vent to who I was and, you know. You know, 68, when I started, the fall of 68, was not an option. You could not talk about it at all. Not at all. In fact, junior year, 2 girls in the freshman class were expelled for being caught, you know, having sex. Yeah, that's what it was like. It wasn't as freewheeling as you thought. it was like the big explosion was free love, but free love meant between men and women. It really doesn't relate so much, because gays had always been, you know, sub rosa. They'd always been, you know, clandestine and furtive, and that continued. It changed a bit in the 70s. It's gotten better with each decade. In the 70s, you know, then I graduated and came out here, and I just wanted to come out with a vengeance and just come out to Los Angeles and just be professionally gay for a time, because I'd sat on it for so long. I hadn't really, you know, given vent to it fully and openly, and so that's why I came out here. And I got busy with that, very busy with that. I lived with my mother when I first moved back because I didn't have any money, and then I met somebody almost immediately, and he asked me to spend the night, and I'd never spent the night with another guy. And so I remember telling my mother, she said, "Well, where are you going?" Because I just moved back. I'd only been there like a month and a half. She said, "Where are you going that you're going to spend the night?" And I said, "Oh, I looked up an old friend from high school who lives out here now, and I'm going to go spend the night with her." "Well, where does she live?" "Well, she lives in so-and-so." My mother was just not buying it at all. And that led eventually to a confrontation where she told me what she thought was happening, and I told her she was right. And she was really pissed off about it, yeah. So she just handled it really, really poorly. And I remember she went that night after I told her to a good friend's house, and she got fall down drunk. And she called me, because I was never drunk. She called me to go pick her up. I had a date that night with this guy. And so I went to pick her up, and she was like sloshing, falling down. And she came back, and I put her in her bathroom, and she was on her hands and knees in the bathroom, vomiting into the toilet. And I was in her room, her bedroom, and I had a zit I was trying to pop before my date that night. And she was saying, "I can't believe my only son's a faggot. He's a faggot. When your father and I were dating, we used to go to nightclubs with your people just to laugh at them." And I remember saying to her, "Well, look at it this way. Now you can just stay home and save yourself the cover charge." And I was never once affected by her unwillingness to accept it or unhappiness. I knew that was her problem. It never fazed me at all. So I was always actually pretty excited about being gay. I always felt I was a member of a secret club, and I always enjoyed it. I always felt I knew something other people didn't, and I liked that. I still do, in a sense. I didn't want people to know where I knew it could affect me detrimentally, like at work or something like that, because you couldn't be out at work. And when I finally went to CBS and I got my first executive job, and I was really lucky, I won out over a lot of people, like 150 people, to get this job. And I had never mentioned in my interviews or anything that I was gay. And so I just thought, I cannot start this job without being honest of who I was. This was 1979. So I was just so nervous, and I marched up to where the people were who had hired me, a staff of three, and I just said, "I got to be honest with you, you know." I got really emotional, and I said, "I can't take this job unless you know the truth, and the truth is I'm gay." And they all said, "Yeah." Everybody knew, which was, of course, a huge blow to my ego, because I thought I was so macho that no one could possibly know that I was gay, and they all completely knew I was gay. From that moment, from that meeting on, I was never not out to anybody in my whole life. And then AIDS hit, and then all hell broke loose. It became a whole different story. So many people I knew were just here, then gone. You know, they were just here, then they were sick for a short time, then they were gone because, there was just nothing to do for them. All these people you'd see who were so educated and so well-meaning, and so this just... nothing like it had ever thrown them into such disarray. No one knew anything. No one knew anything. People were dying by the hundreds, and no one knew why. And there was no mode of treatment, and there was no medication. There was nothing to do. And then, of course, the stigma that came along with it. This guy who was gay but had never really talked about it at all came into my office and said, "Did I worry about that? You know, the disease?" And I said, "Yes, of course I worried." And he said he was worried too. And then 3 days later, he was dead of the disease. I didn't even know he had it. He had a form of it that hadn't really eaten away at his body like so much of the, you know, rest of it. People started to die of different things. Such terrible, you know, almost like science fiction deaths. They were so terrible, the things they'd be covered with and the painful, agonizing ways they die. And Kaposi's sarcoma, which was this kind of skin cancer, these blotchy things that would appear on your skin. Well, you've heard about that. All of a sudden, people had those. And these were things that had never occurred or people had never known about because people's immune systems had never been so compromised before that these things started to, like, appear. And then, you know, you waited for it to come to you or touch you in some way, and it always did, invariably, when you were gay. And that first time that kid came to me at CBS, one of my coworkers, and closed the door and burst into tears and said, I just got tested and, you know, I have it and I don't, there's no medication except that stuff they're selling in Tijuana and I'm gonna go down and bring it in and it's illegal. And then two other people made their way to me at CBS and, you know, and confessed it. And it was the type of thing that you only confess to other gay people because it was just such a stigma and you kept it private. And of course, the interesting thing was, the more promiscuous you'd been, the more you'd opened yourself up to exposure to it, obviously. So the ironic thing was is that some of the most attractive and desirable gay men were the first to go because they'd had so much more sex and, you know, had been exposed to it so many more times. You don't get to go to your prom, your junior prom with your boyfriend, and you don't go to get to Sadie Hawkins with your boyfriend or anything like that. You're just pretending that you are who you're not. A lot of times, a lot of kids, myself included, want to just put all that beside them and just come out explosively and with all kinds of colors and all kinds of, you know, streamers and fireworks and so on. So you go to some city that has a large gay population. What'll happen then when you come out and you do that is you just can't go out enough. You go out every night and you can't meet enough gay people and you can't date enough guys and you can't fool around enough because you just had to deny that part of yourself for so long. You get nuts. And I certainly did that. And then all of a sudden something like this comes along and it just puts a whole different, you know, cast on what it was like to be that kind of crazy and that kind of promiscuous and that kind of involved in the gay community. It wasn't an honorable disease by which to die, like cancer or something like that, where people would elicit sympathy and people would stand by you. No, it was a dirty, reviled kind of sexual gay disease. The stigma was just as poisonous as the disease itself, just as destructive. You died, you know, covered in, you know, vomit, shit, and blood, and people wouldn't touch you. I mean, mortuaries wouldn't embalm you. You were a pariah. There was so much to deal with. It was just a terrible time to be alive and to be gay and to be seeing all your friends die and wondering if you were next and trying to make sense of it all. And by the way, going to work and making a living and really not talking about it with straight people because they didn't really want to know because they were scared and they were thinking, well, do you have it? And do you have it? Is there some way you can possibly transmit it to me? And families didn't want to know. It was just a terrible time to be gay. First of all, Reagan was in office denying the fact that AIDS even existed, not even mentioning it, and people were dying by the hundreds and then by the thousands eventually, and nobody in government was acknowledging or doing anything about it. You know, and all kinds of religious leaders, you know, were quick to jump on the fact that this was, you know, God's retribution or whatever for being gay, and this was the disease he'd visited upon it. And then you forget the psychological ramifications about guys and women who struggled so hard with coming to terms with their gay identity. And there were many more than there should have been who felt this was punishment for their acting out on being gay. And I hated that in particular. That just was heartbreaking to me that, because gay people are just so desperately insecure to begin, not everybody certainly, but many people live, you know, very furtive lives in the beginning and afraid that their parents and their friends are going to reject them. And much more often than not, parents and friends do reject them. You know, and then I found out about myself that I was positive in 89. You know, I didn't get tested for a long, long time. And then I did get tested, and it was positive. And I wasn't, as I recall. I just assumed I would be. And I was. It was just, everything changed. Everything changed. You really changed everything. The only medication available then was AZT. And there was one pharmacy in West Hollywood that really handled the pharmaceutical part of the... And you would go there to get your AZT. And the woman who ran it, she took the little script, and she made this little face, like this sad little face. And she came around the corner to hug me. And I thought, what the hell? What are you hugging me? And, well, of course, she was hugging me because, A, that's what she did in her business. And, B, because it was a, you know, certain death. And so she was just going to say, well, I'm about to give you a medication that will hopefully keep you alive a little bit longer. And then more people came out who were well-known, who were positive, and it lost some of its stigma. And I remember what happened. I was driving to my writing partner's house. I remember exactly where I was. And the radio announced that Magic Johnson had been diagnosed HIV positive. And I thought, we finally have our poster child. We have somebody to put up there who isn't gay, like Rock Hudson had died of it and Liberace had died of it, and everybody just said, ah, gay, you know. Now we had Magic Johnson, who supposedly was straight, who has coming out as HIV positive. And I thought, now we have a poster child, somebody we can point to and say, look, this is how it's affecting the community. And that made a lot of difference. The fundraising became more pronounced. People like Elizabeth Taylor were so great. Other people got involved. And there were huge fundraisers all the time for the disease. And gradually there started to become medication available that was, you know, was certainly still the course of the disease or retarded. But a lot of the medication was toxic. I remember this one guy. Oh, man. There were eight of us that used to play cards together. And this one guy had been sick for a long, long time. And he had such terrible diarrhea that the body rejected everything, so no medication would stay in his system. He'd just take it and it would, you know, come right out again. So the doctor was doing everything they could to try to keep him from having this terrible debilitating diarrhea. Finally, they had him eating clay, doing whatever they could. So you would sit there and he would eat clay in an attempt to kind of, you know, make his stools firm so that the body could hold the medication in and it could absorb it. And that didn't do any good. Clay didn't do any good. And he ended up dying shortly after that. And the doctors, my God, you'd go to your doctor and the doctors would be exhausted. The gay doctors, their whole clientele was AIDS patients. And dying, all of them dying. And then all of a sudden, people started dying a little bit less. And people started obviously living longer. And somehow, some way, and for some reason, I have thus far survived it. I don't know what that means. I'm not sure what it means. And I guess I haven't really spent that much time, you know, dwelling on it. All these years later, I still have been, I mean, I've had cancer twice, so that's not great, but, you know, I've been stable as far as the HIV is concerned. I've been very lucky. Here it is, 2012, I'm still alive. I look like hell, but I'm still alive, you know. So I'm very grateful for that, and I think many times of all the friends and foot soldiers in the gay community who haven't been as lucky as I think about them often. Those people who were so terrified, that friend of mine, that first guy who came into my office at CBS and so terrified, and my talking with him as he cried, and he went a particularly terrible way. I feel a real indebtedness to those people, or I feel like it could get you any number of different ways still, and I'm aware of that, but I've lived to be 62, and so a lot of people never lived beyond their 30s, and my God, there was one guy that I went out for a short time. He died at 26, you know? I mean, it was crazy. It was just crazy shit that was happening. It was just insane. Things that are really painful in life and traumatic and that you can't control, mind, the memory tends to eclipse them as you grow older, you know? So the memories get a little foggy, a little dim. I mean, the memories here are still sharp. The pain is still sharp and so on, but the memories, you want to survive, you have to move forward. You have to think of, you know, progress in the future as opposed to be mired in the pain and anguish of the past. So you have a a responsibility to keep the memory of that terrible time alive.